coming up next on Lutheran Radio UK.
Worth doing badly. Welcome to this week's Worth Doing Badly with me, Jamie Krieger, David Weber, and Ethan Stoppenhagen. On today's episode, we will survey the lessons for the sixth Sunday after the Epiphany according to Series C of the three-year series lectionary. And the lessons are Jeremiah 17 verses 5 to 8, Psalm 1, 1 Corinthians 15 verses 12 to 20, and Luke 6 verses 17 to 26. Today we begin with Ethan Stoppenhagen, followed by comments and questions from David Weber.
Whenever I encounter these passages from the Gospels that are more well-known, like the Beatitudes, and here we have Luke's version of the Beatitudes, I'm always a little puzzled as to what exactly to do with them. And this week I was struck in particular with the phrase that Jesus lifted up his eyes and looked at his disciples. And that phrase is one I've realized is used several times in the Gospels, but not a lot. Dives lifts up his eyes and sees Lazarus in Abraham's bosom. The tax collector doesn't lift up his eyes, and the disciples lift up their eyes at the transfiguration. But what does it mean for Jesus to lift up his eyes? And what are the implications of this phrase, particularly as Jesus is teaching both Beatitudes and woes? This is, I appreciate that Luke combines them, that there's the blessing and there's the woes. And what I found helpful while contemplating this text is the icon of Christ Pantocrator, Christ King of the World, Christ in Judgment, the one from St. Catherine's Monastery on Mount Sinai. It's the one that if you look closely, you'll notice that one half of Jesus' face is stern with a furrowed brow, and the other side is gentle and tender. Both sides, however, are present in Christ as he is judging the world. And if you look closely at the gentle side, you'll see that he has actually lifted up his eye, the eye on that side. So his eyes are lifted up. So what I'd like to try to do is link the Beatitudes to the second coming of Christ, to give them sort of an eschatological spin. Because we do a good job of looking at the Beatitudes and experiencing them as they are, and there's a promised fulfillment of something in the future. But we don't always link that to Christ's judgment and his coming at his coming at the last day. So I don't know if there's any value to this generally from a homiletical perspective, but I think for a preacher that's good to sort of have sitting in the background, because Jesus, as he's teaching them, isn't just a rabbi. He is the Lord of the universe who will come to be our judge. So, David, do you think there's value in traveling down this path, or should we keep going and see what's sticking?
I'm always interested in what is thought but not said, and clearly, in the history of presenting Christ in our own era, we have Christ, this stern, mean judge, and many former Catholics will say they couldn't stand that anymore.
Right.
You know, they couldn't. But the alternative is that you have Christ, the burned-out hippie, and that's no better. And in fact, it's worse, because at least a judge holds to something, believes in something, and can resonate with you when we ourselves hate being poor, we hate being hungry, we hate sorrow, we hate all the things that Christ hates but and judges, But he does it in a way, I think, as you have pointed out, that it takes the focus on our self-absorption, which is it's becoming really, really tiring, and how everything is aimed at self-absorption. And Jesus says, look at the poverty's here so that you can discover real blessedness. You suffer hunger because there's something other than hunger. So I like that if when you approach this difficult passage, and most people, say, sweet Jesus is there when you're poor and you're hungry and you're sorrowful. And that's just another way to remain in self-absorbed, right?
Right.
Let me talk about all my problems. and the problems are real, but the way that Jesus handles them here, the blessedness is more real. And the Christian life is not being self-absorbed in our problems. And I hate to say it, but the icon, you talked about icons, the icon of self-absorption is the comfort dog in churches.
yeah.
I mean, try to square a comfort dog with Christ, the judge, and it just becomes absurd. So
maybe that's the next icon we can have. We can have written as Christ in judgment with his comfort dog next to him.
With his comfort dog. Yeah. Christ at the judgment will have a bunch of comfort dogs. Okay,
well,
sorry.
That's what I appreciate about this icon in particular, is that Christ can be in judgment and still have this, it's not hippie Jesus, but it's a tender look, right? That's realizing that almost can see into your suffering and lift you up. I want to say that the poverty and the hunger and the insecurity that we experience is part of the judgment of Christ. But he's not. But it's the judgment insofar as he has taken the judgment on himself, and now we are imitating what he has endured. And so he can look back at us then with these uplifted eyes to help us see that there's a coming day when all of this will be fulfilled, and that you can actually bear fruit in the meantime. Usually we think of these times when we have nothing as a period of barrenness, but they're actually bearing fruit for the future, that blessedness. And I would say even they're bearing fruit for the present time by teaching us patience and humility. But at the same time, it's preparing us for that weight of glory, which has no comparison. And why do you think then you have the woes contrasted with this? This is what strikes me about Luke's, is that you get the stern side of Jesus, in one sense, who is casting a judgment on those who are, living it up. Because they're the ones who we think, the way Jesus describes them, they're the ones who are truly prosperous, who have everything that we want. Why do you think Jesus speaks those woes at the same time as the Beatitudes?
Well, I think it's almost a poetic balance to the thing, is that when we're poor, we can think of nothing more than to solve the problem of our poverty. And the woes say that there are wrong ways to solve that problem. You know, we've had in the United States, the war on poverty that we continually lose because it doesn't see poverty has its own blessedness. And certainly we're to care for the poor, but just throwing more material goods that are choking all of our culture at the poor is not caring for them. It's making the self-absorbed, there it is again, I'm making the self-absorbed feel good about themselves because they're advocates of the poor. And they never ask themselves, is my advocacy actually helping that particular poor person? And that's what I like what you say about Jesus looking up. He is not looking at a crowd. He's looking at individuals whom he's teaching, right? The poor is not part of a crowd of the poor. Each poor person is someone who individually is suffering and must then be treated not as you know, in a war on poverty. And it's to be done by the church, to be drawn into the church, to be for the church to see that this poor individual is essential for the life of the church. If the body of Christ isn't made up of the poor who are becoming blessed, we're missing a huge part of what it means to be Christians. And, you know, we've talked about this before. We talk a lot. I have not ever been a part of a congregation in which the central part, what Jesus is saying, these people are essential to the faith, the poor, the hungry, the sorrowful. We're pretty good with the sorrowful, but, when we do a food bank, it's not for people within the church. It is for people outside the church that we never get to know, right? And that we right. feel like we've done something if we give them food. So what I really like is the woes are saying, this is not an easy thing. Being poor is not easy, but it's easier than being poor and recognizing that there is a blessedness. That is what you call difficult. And we don't like the difficulty, and so we say that the alternative to being poor is being rich. And Jesus makes it clear, no, that's worse, because there's no blessedness in richness. They already have their consolation. There's no blessedness in not being hungry if the hunger doesn't make you hungry for the immortal life and all that. So
I appreciate you tying it down to the individual person, because that was something I realized as I contemplated this icon, that Jesus does look at each. You can imagine him looking at each individual person who's experiencing each of these realities, and he's acknowledging their burden, but it's not, like you said, it's not this, oh, well, Jesus is with me as I deal with this. It's that it's actually pointing you to, it's Jesus says to them, you've been judged despite what you're enduring to be blessed on account of Christ, and your temporary affliction is actually bearing fruit for eternity. And I think the psalm helps push us in this direction, that the reality of blessedness always has the judgment in view. And of course with the psalm, your Psalm 1, you get this movement, right? The body is engaged. The blessed man is the one who is walking not in the counsel of the wicked and not standing in the way of sinners or sitting in the seat of scoffers, but his delight is in the law of the Lord. He's like one who has planted, a tree planted by streams of water, yielding its fruit in its season. But the problem is, the psalmist tells us that he is always yielding its fruit in its season, its leaf does not wither, in all that he does, he prospers. And so we have to rethink our understanding of prosperity, because what we actually have is that lack of prosperity in the Beatitudes. We're always tempted to see, and they are. I mean, the people who Jesus declares the woes on are prosperous. They're rich and full and laughing and having all sorts of good things said about them. But those things are the things that will be driven away like chaff, because, like you said, it's because of the self-absorption. They haven't been turned out of themselves by God's law. And true prosperity, I think, as the psalmist reveals to us, is always in the long term and having the judgment declared in our favor, so that then we can stand face to face. You know, Jesus has lifted up his face to us, and so we seek to stand face to face with him for eternity, instead of turning and being face to face with the scoffers and the prideful and the self-absorbed.
Have you given any thought to how the psalm is divided between verses 1 and 2, where humans seem to be in control, they have purpose in their walk, they sit in judgment of others in the seat of scoffers, and what delights them is not something that takes the attention off them but puts the attention on them, right? And then how that so what I see is that the one who is blessed is not the one who, the counsel of the wicked. That's the, people who love meetings are wicked, I think. I've always thought that. That's probably not true. But it is interesting to me that the wicked think that they're doing something because they get to go to meetings. Mm-hmm. Or they get to hang out, you know. Let's just hang out. Or they join, you know, the comedians on late night TV where they believe nothing and scoff at everything. That contrast with the alternative is, be planted and wait, you know. So this is off the cuff, but I love the alternative of the busy and the busybodies being just stay put and if your roots are in the ground, the everything else will take care of itself. And, you know, the life that you desire is going to be delivered to you. So it's an interesting contrast. I'd be tempted to start with the psalm and then work my way back to the Beatitudes.
But I think there's great value in that, because what the psalm lays out the fact that this is a long game, right? And that the best thing you can do is to sink your roots down, like you said, into wherever you're at. And that, of course, is totally contrary to what we are trained to think. You know, we're trained to think that if you're hungry, you need to get away from it. If you are, you know, if you are weeping, you need to stop weeping. And if you're poor, you need to be not poor. And if you are hated, you need people to not hate you. And so the psalmist almost encourages us to lean into that. And again, that's not to say that, you know, in some sort of masochistic way that these are things that we should be seeking out. These are things that are imposed upon us, for various reasons on account of our sinful condition. But they are nonetheless things that God is going to use to transform us. So we shouldn't seek to flit around like the scoffers and bounce around, because we're always going to find ourselves it'd be better to find ourselves in the situation of the poor and the hungry than in those who are rich and laughing and having all the nice things said about us.
I recall a long time ago a literary theory called that talked about rhizomatic. It's the idea that the rhizo is a word for root, and when something is rhizomatic, it doesn't send out, it's not a tour de force, it sends out its effect as roots. And one of the parts of the theory is that when a root is blocked, it takes a new direction. Mm-hmm. Right? Mm-hmm. And so we would call those who are hunger and thirst and poor, that would be blocking the root, but it doesn't kill the root. It sends it into new directions. And what we say, that would be a blessedness to that. What we count as an obstruction to our happiness will, what Jesus promises, it will be the source of your happiness.
I really appreciate that rhizomatic approach, because it I think it really gets at what all of preaching is trying to do, is sending out roots, right? We're not here to impress and see the fruit. We're just trying to plant the roots and do a little fertilizing to see how for the word then to bear fruit in the lives of our hearers. So yeah, I would be curious to hear more about that and as you study it. But then of course we turn to the Old Testament lesson, and it is the least fruitful place you could be. Jeremiah here is ironically using the imagery of a bush in the wilderness to describe the man who trusts in his own strength. So you get the contrast in the psalm of the tree planted by the waters, and now you've got the shrub in the desert who trusts in himself, trusts in his own body. And to me, this reminds me of Moses encountering the presence of God in a shrub in the wilderness. So whereas Moses encounters God in the shrub in the wilderness, the prideful man is like the shrub that shrivels up and sees no good. Now, this isn't to say that Moses didn't experience the parched places of the wilderness of Israel, but he trusted in the Lord and was therefore like the man described in Psalm 1. He was a tree planted by water, but it was the water that was flowing from the rock, which was Christ. And so his eyes were always lifted up to God, just as the people lifted up their eyes to the serpent to be saved. And the prideful man, on the other hand, has his eyes cast down. He's dwelling in fear and anxiety, worrying that when he fails to bear what he thinks are important fruit, he's going to disappear into nothingness. But those who trust in the Lord do bear fruit, even in the year of drought and intense heat. And I think that's always a hard thing for us to see. Perhaps
but then Jeremiah knew rhizomatic theory.
He sends
out his roots. That's what it is. It sends out its roots, and the roots are seeking. It's not self-contained. It's seeking the water of life. And amazingly, Jeremiah is knitting together a bunch of our thoughts here. And I love the idea that if you see that your roots, that there are such things as roots and water, and when the two connect, life happens. Once again, anxiety is not part of the picture. You are free from anxiety. And I think most of, you know, again, back to the Beatitudes, the way we talk about blessedness, it's so fragile. It just makes you more anxious.
Right.
Rather than this whole approach to saying the blessedness, it doesn't depend upon us. The blessedness is a promise from God, and in the life of Christ, it shows over and over again how the cross being the quintessential example of something horrible being the source of blessing. So now you must go to the epistle.
And this, you know, and maybe this, you know, sort of rounds us out. Paul sort of rounds us out and helps us realize that all of this is possible because of the resurrection. We wouldn't endure through whatever trials and tribulations of life if we didn't know there was unending life beyond this life. And so we lift up our eyes only because Christ has been lifted up from the dead. He is that, and that's our only hope for, I don't want to say dealing with, but dealing with the Beatitudes as Christ describes them, because we know that we will be raised up with him beyond sin and death. Because if there's no resurrection, this would all be useless. Our faith would be futile. We'd still be in our sins, and the judgment would be eternal death. You know, we experience little deaths right now, but that's because we're being prepared for the one final death that will bring us into life. And since Christ has died and rose again, we know that he's victorious over all the forces of death in this world and transform them into the path of life, so that even when the tree that's been planted by the streams of living water, even when that gets cut down finally at the end, we know that it's going to have a new life, and we might be poor and hungry and weeping and hated, but the resurrection moves us beyond these forces of death to rejoice, because our reward will be to stand face to face with God, because he's lifted up his face towards us and we have lifted up our eyes to him, and that's how we will be in eternity.
Thank you, David and Ethan, and thank you for listening. All the podcasts from this series, Worth Doing Badly, are available from our website, lutheranradio.co.uk. Try our app. Download it for free from Google Play or the App Store. If you have any questions or comments about this or any other program on our schedule, send me an email to manager@lutheranradio.co.uk. I am your host, Jamie Krieger, and I will be back next week with David and Ethan. Thank you again for listening, and stay on for more here on Lutheran Radio UK.